Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Representing for a second time, Whip Six Lacrosse Club!
Oh! Chase, was that you?
Oh no!
Uh-oh.
Did you break the trophy?
No.
Yeah, it was, that was pretty crazy.
Scores! What? What?
You gotta get the ball to 42.
Run Lacrosse!
Hello and welcome back to the PLL Happy Hour Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Brown, alongside Chris Rosenthal for Inside Lacrosse here, just coming back after the All-Star break, and boy, was it fun watching the action unfold from Fairfield, Connecticut and Rafferty Stadium. Jam-packed stands, the fans really showed out again, Chris, and they were treated to some awesome lacrosse on both days. As we saw plenty of action from the Outlaws bouncing back to the Archers pulling away from the Woods and everything in between, with kind of the two biggest games in the middle. The second game on Friday night and that first game on Saturday night with the overtime chaos victory and the Cannons exacting revenge. Rosie, how are you doing? And how much do you enjoy that action from Fairfield?
You know, I guess you can say this for all locations to some degree, but it feels like Connecticut is always treated to some exciting games and some really exciting individual performances, oftentimes from Connecticut players. They seem to really kind of luck out in that regard, and this was definitely no exception on that regard. You know, I mean, just going down the list, talking Connor Kelly, doing his thing. He's always kind of huge in these Connecticut games. Logan Montgomery, huge story coming out of the Atlas game. Another huge weekend for Connecticut.
He took some inspiration, McGovern did, after that Zach Currier goal. So we'll get to all that and much more. But, Rosie, I figured it'll make the most sense if we go reverse chronological order, game-by-game recaps here. And we got our first guest of the season on the PLL Happy Hour podcast. So stay tuned for that coming up later on in the show. But Rosie, let's start off with just freshest in our minds, the last game of the weekend. The Archers pulling away from those lowly Woods at 1-4. It's kind of a disastrous start to the season if you're a Redwoods fan, but this one is all about the Tom Schreiber show. Just the reigning MVP. No one's won MVP as many times in the field pro game as Tom Schreiber. Three-time honoree of the award. He notches his 200th assist and his 400th point in the same game. Two incredible milestones for a midfielder, and for any offensive player, but for a midfielder, Chris Bates said it best post game, just generations are going to look back at this guy. And it's cool to see, just like, I didn't really know his dad was a Hall of Famer until like the last few years. And then just because I've grown up with just watching Tom's highlights. So is Matt Moore, evidently. Just it was kind of a cool moment post game seeing Matt Moore say that, like, yeah, I've been watching your highlights all the time, man. It's like, and Schreiber trying his best not to blush. But Rosie, I got to pose this question to you. Like, how close is Schreiber getting to just becoming the best player of all time, of PLL history, pro field lacrosse history?
I mean, assuming he continues the way he's continuing to play, you know, barring any sort of falling off a cliff, I think when he hangs it up, he's going to be the best professional lacrosse player we've seen. I mean, there's kind of rarefied air in that statement, but, you know, some players didn't have the benefit of having their entire careers taking place during this pro game era. You know, like you look at somebody like a Gary Gate, or somebody like that, or even somebody like a Casey Powell, who was, you know, in and out of the game, just kind of not having the opportunity and exposure that someone like a Tom Schreiber does. And so he comes along in this particular sweet spot where he dominates Major League Lacrosse. And when the PLL is established, he is still performing at such an elite level that he can just seamlessly make that transition into the PLL as well. So he's going to be, you know, kind of one of the great MLL players ever, one of the great PLL players, you know, certainly you can say up to this point. And then, you know, by the time he's done, maybe it'll say one of the greatest PLL players ever in that regard as well. And then, you know, that's not even to mention his contributions to the indoor game, you know, just his NLL stats, even not just for an American, just for anyone. But if you do factor in the fact that he is, you know, an American and still relatively new to it, as opposed to a lot of the guys who get started when they're small children playing the indoor game, you know, he's really checked off every box. You know, if you want to break down the accolades, individual, team, whatever sort of, you know, whatever sort of qualifier you need someone to check off in order to make them be, you know, your GOAT or your greatest or your best of all time, whatever you want the distinction to be, he has really met all of those things. You know, individual honors, like you said, MVP, he's got rings both in the MLL and the PLL, which is something very few players have. And, you know, going forward, the list is going to get smaller and smaller, of course, with guys for that. So, I mean, any sort of criteria you want, it's tough to find someone more qualified than a Tom Schreiber when you're talking about the pro game.
He wasn't shooting the ball great, Rosie, coming into this game, but I really enjoyed both his goals. The first coming off a kind of a signature right to left split, and that kind of signature release of his where it's between a sidearm, and it's more of a sidearm than anything, and just perfectly placed off hip to the goalie, and then that good defense on Rob Pinnell. He kind of forces a pass, late shot clock, and seeing Shriver just sprint, 32 years old, and he's still outrunning everyone to be whistle ready, and a really nice unsettled opportunity there. But it's his assist that really steals the show. Like, his offhand skips to everyone, but just the one on the doorstep, the Fields, was really nice off of kind of a broken play off a scrum. And then, man, the second one, the Fields, well, it was just spectacular and made SportsCenter with the behind-the-back finish. There's nothing he can't do. Like, he's so good everywhere. And like you said, like, he meets every criteria to say he's one of the best. And I think it is going to be pretty soon that we're going to be calling him the best of all time in the pro ranks. And like you said, it's obviously some circumstance plays into it, but Schreiber is just incredible to watch. And really, he's just so great for the game. Like, seen him post game and stuff, just try not to blush with Matt Moore praising him, but also keeping every answer is team first and deflecting every opportunity he gets. So before we kind of move on to any other games, just Rosie, 7-goal loss for these Redwoods. What are some of the major problems you're seeing with this California group, and like, what are some solutions maybe that Nat and company have to implement?
Well, so, you know, it's kind of interesting. Before the game, Nat was kind of discussing some kind of inconsistencies in his roster. It wasn't a tremendous amount, but Dana Boyle asked him about Chris Gray being out and Isaiah Davis Allen being out. And, you know, he kind of remarked that they were gone and they're going to have to, you know, kind of adjust accordingly. But then, you know, later he pointed out that they've had the core in place the whole time. And it's not a dramatic swing in who's there and who isn't. You know, he referred to it, I think, a couple of times as their core, and their core has been there. You know, you have your Pinnells and your Garnsies, and, you know, your Montgomerys and your Romar Dennis, guys like that. They've been there every single week. So really the question comes down to, is that core good enough to produce at a level that's going to beat these other teams? And, you know, it's kind of like, you can have perfect attendance, but if you're getting bad grades, it doesn't necessarily matter if you're there every day. You know, maybe you have to change something up. You got to switch some classes or do some, you know, transfer or something like that. So I think the big question is, as far as this season goes, is, you know, barring any sort of, you know, shakeups we know nothing about, does he have enough on the field right now or in that locker room to beat enough of these other teams moving forward? And, you know, based on last year's production, I would have thought so. But based on what we've seen this year, particularly, I've hammered this several weeks in a row now, I think, particularly out of the midfield, they just have not gotten enough production. You know, I think they were counting on some guys to be at least as good and perhaps, you know, take a leap. You know, we always say that kind of thing. Oh, if it goes to the next step, then they'll be great. But they haven't really seen that kind of next step from anyone out of that midfield. So I don't think they have the answer right now in that group. And if they do, they're going to have to show it to us for the first time this season.
And it's not exactly a straightforward path to exactly like what you said, solving any of their issues this season. Some of the lineup continuity issues with Chris Gray being in and out and trying to find their identity still while turning it over quite a bit, carelessly at times. But Rosie, I want to propose a couple of things to you. And this is the other thing, like, it's not very easy to tank in this league. Like, the tank in the NBA, you trade away some of your better players if you have a clear vision, you want to get a high-end lottery pick. I think that, like, forget your homecoming weekend. The playoffs are still very much in sight. But with what you've got rostered, you've got Cole Kastner coming into your defense next year. You've got Owen Grant coming back from injury. So that's an Owen Grant, Cole Kastner. Owen Grant can maybe play LSM. And you got Arn Cohen, and Chris Fake has looked great the last few weeks, solidifying your defense, new look defense. Maybe you get a goalie upgrade. But the number one pick is obviously going to be CJ Kirst in this next 2025 draft. It's not the generational draft of this year, of course, but it's you're getting a stud at number one if you start the tanking mission now. And you get the San Diego crowd into it. They start chanting, trust the process, and you get some Sixers folklore in there. But it's like you're looking at these other teams, and like to do that, like, you would want to trade a guy like Ryder Garnsey, who plays in the same position as CJ Kirst. And you look at the other lefty attackmen around the league, Brendan O'Neill, Kieran McArdle, Josh Byrne, Matt Rambo is on the PUP list right now. So it's mostly TJ Malone, Levi Anderson for the Whips, Jeff Teed on the Atlas. And it would be funny that if the Cannons did something like this after just signing Will Manny and having Matt Kavanaugh and Garnsey on the same team for years, which we would always think of trade ideas because they play the same lefty attack position. Fields on the Archers. So this is a crowded position. So it's not really like the best way to go of trading Garnsey away, but I'm just trying to think towards the future with this squad. And I think you put all your balls in the 2025 court for if you're a Redwoods guy.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, what certainly could happen is, like you said, heading into this, this San Diego weekend, you know, if they do win one or two, then they're almost kind of like, maybe they squeak into the postseason and lose that number one spot. And then they're kind of they're like, yay, we're winning, but at what cost? You know, but in the same time, it really seems right. Like, you know, at least from what we're hearing, and I do want to preface that by saying we never hear anyone say that they're not happy with their team or they're not confident with the direction they're going. Regardless of the record, everybody who gives, you know, their sound bites at the press conference says, you know, I believe in the team and, you know, I love these guys and this and that. So assuming we take them at, you know, at what they're saying, take them for their word, you know, guys like Nat and guys like Rob Pinnell are still confident that they have the answer in that locker room. So, you know, we will see. It is a momentous game changer if they pull off one or two of these wins in this homecoming weekend. You know, big picture wise, I don't know what it would mean. You know, if, for example, if they beat, you know, Carolina, I'm not sure that puts them in a closer position to winning the championship. But, you know, I guess they're just fighting to avoid elimination at this point, really. So I don't know. They have a lot of questions still. The Chris Gray thing, I don't know if when they acquired him, they knew he was going to be out for two games. You know, like, what is the, you know, what is the price you pay to pick up Chris Gray? Is he going to continue missing games? Is this the last one? We don't really know that situation. I would like some more insight on it. I'm not sure how much we're going to get or be, you know, provided for that. So I'm not really sure. I would be very curious as to what kind of, if there's any like buyer's remorse on that trade at this point, or also the Levi Anderson trade. That certainly seemed like more of an eye to the future. So, you know, maybe they thought the writing was on the wall as far as 2024 as well with that one. So I think they're kind of trying to stay flexible either way. You know, if something goes great, that's good. They're going to have a lot of good individual stuff as far as Rob Pinnell goes. You know, he's got some, you know, 600 point mark is all but a certainty at this point, the way he's been playing. Most likely in front of his home crowd. So that should be a big thing for them as well. And so, you know, they've got some good stuff to be happy about, but I think they've probably been pretty miserable this season is what I'd guess.
Flexibility is key. They definitely got talent to make a turnaround starting with their doubleheader and their homecoming weekend. And we'll get to that later on the episode. The last thing I want to hit on in this game before I, cause I want to spend some, a little bit more time in some of the more interesting games that weren't as, this wasn't quite a blowout, but 15-8 compared to the other games. Mike Sisselberger, man, like he was not having the best season. So the come in against TD Erlin and do what he did was super impressive and really tilted the field in the Archers' favor. And they're a team that will exploit you in that 32-second shot clock offense. So kudos to the Sis for, you know, staying with it, sticking with it. And TD Erlin's been awesome this year. He's been, I think, he was in my midseason team of the year, all midseason kind of team. And check out plug, team of the week 7, Mike Sisselberger, your boy. Great game from the wrestler of the league. Rosie, let's go right along to the first game on Saturday, which was Atlas Cannons, the ABC matchup of the weekend. Cannons avenged the season opening loss 17-12, largely thanks to 3 2-pointers spanning the end of the third quarter and to start the fourth quarter. Jeff Teat held the 2 assists, Xander Dixon to a goal. Connor Schellenberger pointless for the first time in his rookie season. What a defensive display from these Cannons, man. Just super impressive. And the 2-point shooting was just something to behold. Rosie, what are some of your takeaways from this one?
Well, I mean, boy, it was kind of a night and day sort of performance from, you know, the first time we saw these guys play. And we're seeing, kind of getting into the stage of the season where we get, you know, rematches from earlier in the year. And, you know, we saw the Atlas attack really run over them in the first matchup. And this one, they all just, so I will say this, there was a part of it that just seemed like they played poorly. I want to obviously give a ton of credit to the Cannons. Yes. The Cannons did a great job. You know, their defensive scheme seemed to work out very well. A lot of aggressive sliding and, you know, kind of fake sliding and kind of baiting passes. And they did great stuff in that regard. So I'm certainly not going to sit here and say it had nothing to do with the Cannons defense or with Kirsten Gohl, who was excellent, you know, really getting early jumps to their shots, to the Atlas shots. But it was probably also the worst I've seen the Atlas attack play you know, with their own, like, just they weren't pleased with it, and they shouldn't have been pleased with it. You know, we saw Xander Dickson just kind of drop an open look right on the crease. You know, how often are we going to see that? We saw both Dixon and Teat miss on behind the back shots pretty close to the crease. You know, just shoot them wide. Jeff Teat had an early behind the back shot, like real early in the game, that it actually, I think, decreased his angle to go behind the back on it. It looked like if he stayed overhand, it was actually a much better shot. So they weren't playing well, and like the execution just wasn't there. There was another play where I actually had to kind of rewind this and pause it a little bit. Jeff Teat is sweeping towards the middle of the field, and he has gotten about two steps on Garrett Eppel, and there is no slide coming, and he passes it off to, I think it was Schellenberger on the wing. And really what he did is it's like going up for a layup and then an uncontested layup and then kicking it out to somebody. It was like, it's a shot. You take that shot, right? And he would take that shot, you know, 9 times out of 10. The only reason I'm saying 9 instead of 10 is I just saw him pass it up once. It was just kind of like that. Like, it was bad. It was not good stuff from very, very talented attackmen. Just all three made plays that I don't think we'll see them consistently make again. You know, Jeff Teat was doing the press comments after the game and was, you know, visibly upset, just, I think, by the outcome. And you know, for good reason. It was not their best work. But again, like I said, you know, I'm definitely not going to shortchange the Cannons on this. They had a great, great game plan. Their defense was great. Offense, peppering Entenmann from shots all over. You know, the kind of offensive depth that they're running with right now, you're getting scoring from everywhere. You know, range wise, position wise, it's really tough to kind of plan for that kind of stuff if you are, you know, you're trying to go against the Cannons, but you don't know if, you know, Ryan Drenner or Chris Haslanian or, you know, Matt Campbell or, you know, Jeff Traynor is now a, you know, preeminent two-way midfielder. Just constant offensive threat. You know, Holman pulling up for bouncers for two. You know, it's a lot going on. They're a nightmare to deal with right now. So they do get a lot of credit, but, you know, not for nothing. Atlas had a lot of stuff they're probably really upset about as well.
Yeah, to your point, like, there were so many, I think, open shots. I think, to your reference, I think before Teat was passing that really open look up, he had some really open looks where just, and credit cursed, of course, credit column cursed. You got to make the saves. If they're right, even if they're right at you, but some of these shots were right at him, and for some of the most accurate shooters in the league, call it the curse of the Kevin Brown Friday feature. But the shooting percentages of these guys coming in were all in the top 20. If you're hitting like 30-35%, that's where you want to be. They were all like 46% and above. So like, right. They did not shoot the ball well. And so to your point, definitely they were ruining their chances. But yeah, man, the Cannons are real tough to deal with. Like you said, like the 2-point shooting, Coach Brian Holman mentioned it post game. They'd be silly not to coach it. Like, they'd be silly not to encourage it when it's such a momentum swinging play. And you saw it just catching fire like that. Making 3 of your 4 attempts is one thing, but hitting 3 of them in a row to make a 1-goal lead a 7-goal lead is just a whole different story. So super cool in the ways they got that space to get the 2-pointers too. I mean, the Jeff Traynor one was just a wide open transition one, but nice little skip to the Connor Kearst at the kind of end of the looking for something in the shot clock. And the Marcus Holman weave play, it just never disappoints. What a high bouncer that was. Fun to watch that Marcus, the sharpshooter of sharpshooters, just never gets old. Rosie, anything else before we hit on the Friday games?
Yeah, so I do want to say that kind of doubling down with the whole Atlas talk, I think what happened a lot is they kept having something great go well for them and then instantly sabotaging it. You know, like we mentioned, like the start of the podcast, we were talking about Logan McGovern. I think I called him Montgomery, but Logan McGovern comes in, huge play, right? That's hometown, first goal. He gets in the game. That should be so huge, right? Like mega juice goal. Next time down, they throw the ball out of bounds. It was just kind of like that every single time. They'd have something great happen, and then they just did not want to be great during this game. Miles Jones had a huge goal. Like, and it was another one of those sort of huge, wow, this is great. He's doing great. He's crushing everybody. He had a couple tough games. Should have been huge.
What a BTB assist, too.
Yeah, it was just phenomenal play is what we're used to seeing from them. And then Ethan Rall comes down right away and just silences them. It was just constantly like that. That's obviously not necessarily as much Atlas' fault as you want to credit Ethan Rall for making the great play off the ground ball there. But it was just kind of symbolic of the way that their whole game kind of went. Also, I do want to send a quick shout out to Zach Tucci for cheating during one of their face-offs. I don't know if you saw that. Pushed it forward and grabbed the ball with his hand and tossed it back to Bubba Fairman, which is another thing that stopped an Atlas run. Atlas had scored, and you know who knows what happens if you know Tucci doesn't do what he has to do there. You know, if Atlas get that ball,
did they call it?
No call. It's just players screaming about hand pass. No call by the refs. And yeah, like they were able to silence what could have been a big Atlas run again. But you know, you got to do what you got to do. So shout out Tucci Maine for cheating and not getting caught.
This was a huge game. See, well, first off, credit you because I wasn't positive you said Montgomery for McGovern. So way to own up to your mistake there. But this was a huge game. Jeff Teat said it leading up to it. Like, people may not realize how big of a game this is for the PLL overall standings and the Eastern Conference standings. Getting a first round bye by winning the East is you really want that to advance to the second round of the PLL postseason in this new format this season. Remember, it's a 6-team postseason. The first place in the East, first place in the West, they both get bye weeks in the first round of the playoffs. Then the next four teams are just seeded based off overall record. So, as it were right now, it's the Boston Cannons are in a New York Atlas are both tied at 5-2. Of course, the Atlas are up by score differential, but we'll see how that unfolds as the rest of the season goes because the Archers are in their West and they're looking like they're on course to secure that bye. So going into the throwback of all throwback matchups during throwback weekend. Chaos 10 in overtime against the Whipsnakes is 9. This was a pretty kind of physical grudge match following a entertaining, high-scoring first game of the weekend. So it's kind of a change of pace game to end your Friday nights for PLL Friday night fans. Chaos, what a victory. Three straight losses coming into their like triple bye week for the All-Star break and their own personal break and kind of the league had a break in there too. So they had a lot of time to kind of reflect on those three losses, and this is just the way they wanted to come out and bounce back for a win over their rivals.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're having trouble putting up points, the solution is either put up more points or make sure the other guys score less, right? And so obviously option A wasn't in the cards for them. So they just had to kind of make sure the Whipsnakes couldn't get anything going. And, you know, I don't know if 10 goals is going to beat a lot of teams all the time, but the way the Chaos defense was looking, and of course, when you have Blaze back there, it's just sometimes 10 is enough. I don't think the Whipsnakes are going to be pleased with their shot selection. In fact, Jim Snyder mentioned it in the post game. A lot of shots right at his feet, right at Blaze's feet. He made it look easy. He always makes it look easy, but you know, even by Blaze standards, he made a lot of these stops look especially easy. You know, when they got him moving a little bit, got him going laterally or turning around, or, you know, plays from X or things of that nature, he was a little more vulnerable as any goalie would be. But like they always say, the shots you should stop, he always stops those. And, you know, you get a couple that he, pulls out that only he can do. And that's kind of the recipe to these 10-9 victories, which might just be what this Chaos team's going to need to rely on, right? Like, maybe they don't have the high-octane sort of formula that we've grown used to seeing them in the past when you had, say, a Dane Smith and Josh Byrne working in tandem and, you know, things of that nature. It hasn't really played out consistently for them like that, but they have had more consistency on the defensive side. Maybe this kind of game is something that springboards something for a young guy like Shane Knobloch, right? Who had been kind of struggling recently. I think he was another person they kind of relied on to fill the gap, to, you know, shake things up in their new offense. You know, he gets in this situation and they do, you know, dump some high expectations on him as a newcomer, but they do need that new identity. And things hadn't been going well for him. He was like 2-for-15 in the three games leading up to this, but has two huge goals in this one, like the overtime game winner. So something like that can build some energy and some confidence for somebody, then it definitely could for him as well.
No one embodies I wouldn't say no one, but the rookie embodiment of the swagger and confidence that, of course, swagger and arrogance, excuse me, from the Andy Tower School of Being a Chaos Player's mindset is just it's fun to watch with Knobloch doing the Dame Willard, pointing to the wrist, game time. It's Nobby time at the end there. And post game, it was really fun to hear him right next to Andy Towers' state. And he was like, listen, I just told Coach, too. So it's like, I was not happy. I was pissed even being left out on the sideline when three other midfielders run on the field to start overtime. Lucky for him, Reardon makes that near side save on Chanchuk, which was a pretty good look, but maybe not the one. You don't have him moving enough to kind of get a great chance there and sudden death. And if you give Reardon a chance, he's going to get his offense an opportunity. And once Nobby got it, he just really wanted to make a play. So it was cool hearing and seeing those two interact, Knobloch and Andy Towers post game. Just, he's got that confidence, man. And it was a huge turning point, like you said, for him. He was not shooting the ball well at all. He's getting a long pull coming out of the college game, which he was terrorizing every long pull in the college game, but the LSMs at the pro level are just that much better. And when you pass up on guys like Pat Cavanaugh and Matt Brandau and all these other studs that come from the TJ Ballone in the third round, like, list goes on. You're looking for someone who brings a little more production than what Knobloch had coming into week 7. So to see him score that nice near side rip earlier in the game and have that moment. Fortunately for Jake Bernhardt, both goals were against him. So we're going to have to see a little more slides coming to his way if he matched up against Knobloch in the future. But huge moment for the rookie coming out of Rutgers. And it was also for the Whipsnake side, just first time seeing a Rambo-less offense this season. He's been injured in the past, but sent to the PUP list, as we mentioned earlier. TJ Ballone kind of takes that lefty spot with the quarterbacking skills that he has that he also employed at Penn State. And, Rosie, what were your thoughts of kind of how the offense looked overall without Rambo, and just what'd you like and not like from some of the personnel out there, and what was the reigning rookie of the year's debut? season debut?
Well, so, I mean, if I had to pick one word to describe the Whipsnakes offense right now, it would kind of be like, I'd just kind of say sporadic. You know, you'll see good things, and then you'll take a real long break, and then maybe you'll see something good again, right? Like, we saw the Zed Williams-Jack Rowlett matchup, and, you know, Zed has that jump shot that is just, it's effectively unguardable, right? I mean, because he just has so much mass behind the jump shot that he gets up in the air. And, you know, some guys try that shot and they just instantly get dumped on their backs. But, you know, he's just so massive and can just shoot the ball so hard using, you know, his torso essentially, that he just kind of elevates over his defenders. And, you know, about a week prior, Jack Rowlett had specifically discussed how difficult it was covering Zed of all people. You know, he's like, give me a quick matchup, I'll go against the shifty small guys all day, but it's a nightmare covering somebody like Zed. And you know, we saw exactly why. So he was able to do what he wanted to do on that shot. If I'm Stagnita, I'm just telling him, listen, we're gonna need about 8 takes at least every half. Just get the ball and do your thing. It kind of seems like he's the most consistent option right now. We see some really, really great things from Levi Anderson time to time. So again, he's kind of, I guess, just kind of by nature of being a rookie, kind of learning when and where to pick his spots. You mentioned the reigning rookie of the year. Tucker Rodovic comes back, goal right away. You know, it kind of been probably waiting for that for a long time. You know, he just recently gotten his foot out of a boot. So, you know, hopefully everything was good to go so he can just kind of continue progressing and staying healthy the rest of the year, because he's a very valuable weapon coming out of that midfield. I think he took 9 shots, if I'm not mistaken. So he's just kind of, you know, making up for lost time on that. He is a volume shooter, but, you know, that's what they need sometimes as well, kind of keep the field stretched. So they have some pieces in play. You mentioned Bernhardt. I do have to touch on it because it's kind of offense related, but kind of not offense related. I think they've had a lot of difficulty regarding not just the defensive midfield coverage wise, but definitely coverage wise in defensive midfield, but also transition wise, when to take the opportunities and when to just do your job, which is getting the ball to the offensive people. They shot themselves in the foot a few times during that Chaos game, where, you know, it's like, well, let's get the ball down. Like I said, you know, let's give it to Zed again. Let's give it to TJ Malone. And I feel like a lot of teams have this problem. Maybe it's just by nature of you being, you know, the best at your position, your entire life or whatever. But a lot of, you know, short stick midfielders will come down and they'll say, well, I'm going to go ahead and rip it here. And it's like, well, you know what? Those other guys are way better at scoring goals than you are. So maybe just give them the ball and get off the field, right? They had a couple problems with that. And if you're in a situation like the Whipsnakes right now, where you're just walking so thin a tightrope between winning and losing in these games like this, and, you know, more so than any point of the season before, just winning is just of the utmost priority. You have no wiggle room on this, right? Just get the ball to the guys who are known for scoring the goals, right? Maybe don't risk it if you don't have any goals this year, right? Maybe it's not your time to invert it and call your own number if you're a D-middy. Maybe just get out of everybody else's way. And I feel like they're kind of hamstrung by that a bit as well. So they've got some offensive good stuff going for them, but they got to make sure everybody's on the same page with it.
It was hilarious listening to the broadcast in real time with Coach Jim Stagnita just flat out ignoring head coach Jim Stagnita at certain points. And it ended up working in their favor a couple times. To your point, Roman Puglisi was across the midline. And again, it's like, these are guys who can score in transition 10 yards out of the midfield. You're that much closer to the net all of a sudden. And then you hear Stags on the sideline. He's like, just pass it, Roma. Come on. He gets rid of it. He ends up scoring like 2 seconds later on a nice cut on a kind of a broken play. Later on, He's begging Levi Anderson, the center razor pick at GLE. Does not do it. Camps himself right on that wing and just walks it in for an easy score on a kind of a miscommunication from the Chaos defense. But Stags can only applaud. He's like, good job, guys, for just completely ignoring me. Almost to the fact where I'm like, is he just second level, just chess playing these other coaches? Like, he's just yelling these things for the other players to maybe lack some attention, and they're like, he's telling them to do this other thing, and players know, like, actually this means the opposite. And did not seem like it from Stagnita's facial expressions, but he may be one step ahead of the curve yet again.
I think what's happening is, like, Staggs is like one of the longest tenured professors at a very prestigious university, and all of his students are treating him like a substitute teacher. They're just not listening to anything he's saying, and he's like, "Here's the strategy," and they're like, "Yeah, okay, we got it." And then they're just rolling out nonsense. And, you know, when it works, you say, okay, great job, fellas. And when it doesn't, then, you know, he's just kind of staring like, what are you guys doing? Why isn't anybody listening to me? And, you know, I mean, at the end of the year, it's going to come down to the wins and losses. And if they don't have enough wins, they're not going to look back and laugh at that kind of stuff. But when you win, you can have a chuckle about it, you know? So it really is just going to come down to winning and losing, about how memorably he's going to look back on things like this.
2-4 right now in the ultra talented East Turn Conference. The Whipsnakes are heading into week 8 as we head to San Diego next. Before we flip the page, let's finish up with the first game of the weekend, Rosie. The Denver Outlaws coming back from a 17-4. Crazy loss to Atlas last time out. Now defeating the Philadelphia Water Dogs at a lowly 1-5. Unbelievable. 15-3. Really fun game, this one. I think the most enjoyable of the weekend. And you saw the Outlaws just battle it out, man. Like, the 15-13, just seeing Dalton Young kind of go off in those short shot clock situations, and Water Dogs again kind of collapsing in that fourth quarter with another scoring drought. Denver Outlaws goalie Owen McElroy certainly locking it down a little bit with 16 saves. I think his best pro game, close to 60% in net. Rosie, just this one was super fun to watch. Eric Law comes in, just that everything we mentioned with the Water Dogs. But what would you like out of this one? Let's start with kind of the Eric Law effect coming in as that vet into this. All of a sudden, pretty talented attack line alongside. I think Josh Sawada was running out of the box a little bit, but obviously they got the number one pick. Brennan O'Neill, who bounces back with a hat trick and 4 points too.
Yeah, you know, I think obviously for, you know, nostalgia's sake, or, you know, whatever sort of heartstring that tugged on hearing that Eric Law was heading back to the Denver Outlaws, even pushing all of that aside, this was the kind of reason why a team like the Outlaws needed someone like Eric Law. They have all these pieces who are very young on the offense, talented, and, you know, you can see the vision, right? You can see what they're looking to do, but you need somebody who's been there 1,000 times, who sees the game. I mean, no doubt Eric Law sees a pro game so much more slowly than anybody else on that Denver offense. You know, like, he's seeing things in super slow motion. You know, he's got line mates who've played in, you know, a few games. You know, if you played in 4 games or something like that, it's no matter how good you were in college, or no matter how many, you know, high school All-American tournaments you played in or something like that, it's different than getting to a PLL game where all of a sudden you're lined up against the literal greatest players in the world at all positions. And you just need somebody who can slow it down for the team, who can, you know, walk them through some difficult points. And what he kind of offers in addition to the whole veteran leadership thing is he's so good off ball and so good with kind of the, you know, kind of the plays after the plays, you know, like when things don't go quite according to plan, he has the second option there. He knows what to do. He's got a plan A and a plan B and plan C. So basically you need also somebody like who can take the really great dodges and really great starts to plays that the Outlaws offense could generate. You know, they have young, talented dodgers, and he can curl around, or once there's that slide, he can get to the open space. So what could ordinarily kind of be a good opportunity is now going to turn into a good play and a good goal. And that's just kind of the huge difference, I think, that Eric Law brings to this offense that really just kind of needed an end to their story instead of just kind of a great beginning to it.
No, absolutely. And cool to see O'Neal bounce back with he had that downhill goal. He had that low angle goal and another sweeping goal. Three signature moves of his. He's really made his bread and butter at the college level. So the Water Dogs, on the other hand, similar to the Atlas in that they had their chances. Like, they had a lot of shots late, and as I alluded to, McElroy made some great saves, but there are just some shots. Like, Sauer's got topside with his left off a nice two-man game from behind, and you never really see him miss that wide. He was visibly frustrated with himself after that shot. A lot of quirks. It's kind of sad to see. It was a tough watch to see one of my favorite players in the college game, Matt Brando. He really hasn't found his footing yet. Not looking too settled in. Very jittery. Doesn't look like he has too much confidence with just the firepower on this Water Dogs team. Like, he knows every run is a tryout. It's a trial run with guys like Jake Caraway being sent to the reserve roster, Mikey Boehm looking for his chance still. So they've got a lot of people they can insert in the lineup still. It was really cool to see Mikey Schlosser also on Throwback Weekend make his season debut. In fact, he's a long injury recovery for him, almost 2 years it was, to see him get that goal down the alley, stick to the inside, cool as you like with that left hand, paints the pipe. He's so fun to watch. He was making so many fun, just simple plays, moving it forward, beating his guy, moving it forward. That would start the kind of defensive rotation, and Water Dogs were getting great looks after that. Like, but sometimes it just takes a little bit of brilliance, some nice athleticism, and that cut it to one with Zach Currier's air gate. That, Rosie, I think you got a take on this one. What's your take on this awesome from the side goal that he does pretty often?
I don't know if it's a take. Maybe it's just a desire for clarification, and then I will roll it into a take, I suppose. Is that an air gate? Because I saw that tweeted out on a couple accounts, and it was like Zach Currier with the air gate. I feel like that's just a dive, and I'm not downplaying it because it's an extraordinary goal. It's amazing. It is, you know, tremendous athleticism and great sort of, knowing when and where to execute such a great play. I mean, I'm certainly not saying it's not good, but I don't think that's an air gate. Do I not know the definition? I thought an air gate was as done by Gary Gate. You dunk the ball over the top of the goal. I feel like that is what an air gate is. Right. Yeah, so everything else, I feel like, isn't that, therefore isn't an air gate.
Hold on, I'm looking back. Because he was pretty close to the corner of the net on this dive, but I don't think I'm agreeing with you. I don't think it was an air gate. I think it was to the side, like Logan McGovern's.
I think there are very few people who execute air gates during professional field games. You mentioned, Courier coming around. And,
yep. It was over the shoulder.
Indoor, you do see that a bit more. You know, if somebody gets a good bounce off of the back wall, or, you know, you catch the goalie napping or something like that. You know, we do see that a little bit more. But yeah, I think an air gate is, it's okay for a thing to just be a thing. And I think an air gate is if you dunk it over the back. Josh Byrne tried one and almost pulled it off. He's capable of doing it. We've seen it before. But it's pretty rare to do it because it's really tough, I think. You really have to have the right opportunity and have that mindset that you're going to do it at that time, because, you know, you do need a bit of a running start. Some of us need a lot more of a running start than others, but still. So I'm just checking here. I don't think that's actually an air gate. Not that there's anything wrong with it, because it's an awesome play regardless, but I don't think that's actually an air gate.
Definitely not an air gate to the side. Still probably the best play from the weekend, although the Sauer's BTB assist to the McArdle, just so silky smooth. But nothing beats the Mikey Powell jumping across the back of the net with that diving goal. I think that one was definitely the best. Not even Aaron Brent Adams could he hit the air gate a couple times, but the Mikey Powell is one-on-one.
That shot makes no sense. Because, I mean, here's the thing about that shot that's different from any sort of air gate. If you don't do it, if you can't cover that distance, you just get caught up in the back of a net like a fish, and everybody's looking at you like you're a jerk. They'd be like, why did you think you could do that? Because it's stupid. It's so dumb to try that if you aren't like 120% sure that you have the kind of, I don't even know, the horizontal leaping ability to go from one side of the cage to the other. That shot is probably the most ridiculous shot I've ever seen, because I don't know what would make somebody think they could do that, unless they've done it, you know, countless times when nobody was
freak watching. Athlete he was, Mikey Powell. And so the Water Dogs, they fall 1-5. Still just mind-boggling to me that they've lost five of their first six. Still time to turn around. But Chris, let's get to the other side of the ball here, where we mentioned the Eric Law effect, Brendan O'Neill getting back on track. We talked about the two-point prowess from the Cannons earlier in the episode. Graham Bundy was awesome. He almost a hat trick of two-pointers in this one. I caught up with Graham earlier today to talk about the win in our first guest of the season. Let's roll it to hear from Graham, and we'll be back with some closing remarks.
We now welcome on Outlaws rookie midfielder Graham Bundy Jr. Graham, welcome to the show.
Kevin, thanks for having me.
Pleasure is all mine. Coming off a big bounce back win from your Outlaws, beating the Philadelphia Water Dogs, sending them to a lowly 1-5. Now you guys propel up to 3-2 in the Western Conference standings after that huge defeat, 17-4 against the top of the league, Atlas. So much needed bounce back win from you guys, like you said, post game too. Just how good did that feel first off, and just to have a big role in it too, 5 points with the goal and a couple 2-pointers in there.
Yeah. Again, you already mentioned it, and I think a lot of our guys mentioned it in interviews post game, but that was definitely a big win for us to stay above 500 there. Not the way you want to go out going into a two-week by there with our Atlas performance. But, you know, I think there's so many talented teams across the league, and we knew we were going to have a battle with the Water Dogs. I mean, don't be fooled by their record. I mean, that's a team that's lost so many one goal and with us now two goal games. So, I mean, they're just in it with all of the best of them in the league. So, again, definitely a big win for us and back on the right track.
No, absolutely. And back on the right track, and back in the shooting form for yourself, just a couple two-pointers. The one was, I don't know, I still haven't seen conclusive evidence that that wasn't a two. I'm sticking that you're wrong, Tim. You should have had a hat trick of two-pointers in that game. But remind me, so you also had 5 points against the California Redwoods a few weeks back. After that game, your head coach, Tim Sudan, came up to the podium, and he was joking to us media, talking all about your shooting woes the practice night before, told you that you had to switch sticks. What's the real story behind that? Did you end up using your backup stick for that game against the Redwoods?
Yeah, it was my backup stick. I'm never someone who's like known too much about gear or equipment, and luckily I've had some guys that can string up good sticks, and so throughout my years I've been bouncing around trying to figure out what works, but I feel like my like heads and stuff warp pretty quickly, so I'm always like constantly sometimes changing it. It like breaks on my follow through if I hit like a shaft or something. So a series of unfortunate events led to me like not being extremely confident. And funny story with that practice, or just my mindset after that practice, it was some of the worst shooting you would ever see. It was not even close to the goal. It would like yank so high up in my stick or just down into the ground. And I'm like, coach, like you may need to just play with 18 guys, like forfeit the 19th guy, play with 18. So I got a few reps in. Luckily we're the early game, so we got to go out on the field. So spent about an hour out there and worked with the backup stick there, and it came back to form. So I'm glad for that. All my boys were super uplifting, but afterwards they were like, oh my God, I didn't mean any of that. You got it? I was like, no way. So it was good. It was a funny story, but I'm glad it worked out.
So you've been using the backup ever since? It's now become the starter?
It's now become the starter. And so hopefully I'm gonna use as much of the life that it has in it. And I just got to start preparing a backup stick, I guess.
Yeah, no, you absolutely do. It's now that you're in the pro ranks, you got to have that ready. And I do remember you coming up for the quarterfinal game for your final season at Georgetown here. Just you're one of the first ones out of the field. Like the amount of shots you must put up pregame, postgame, during the week. No wonder there's so much wear and tear in your sticks. I mean, it really does make sense. Was it just getting like stuck in your pocket, and then just flying, God knows where?
Yeah, I mean, I've just recently learned the difference between like semi-soft, semi-hard, like all that mesh. So I found out that soft is gonna yank harder, and like the pocket's gonna be deeper, obviously. And when it's hot out, like it warps, and I'm just a series of bad events. And I was just yanking everything. It was staying in the stick way too long. Like I would almost shoot it full throttle, and it'd almost still be in my stick. And I'm like, this can't be legal. It was a mess. But yeah, coach was like, try out the backup. Well, I was like, what should I do? I was like, I have a backup. Someone needs to restring it. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do. He was like, all right, just throw it with the backup. I like hit two pretty solid shots with the backup, and we're like, okay, we're going to go with that one.
So have you been tinkering with the backup since? Did you give it to someone to restring, or
no? We just stayed with the backup.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, my like the bottom mesh like starts to rip just because I feel like when I shoot it yanks on it super hard, so it starts shredding a little bit. So just minor adjustments in there, but gonna try to keep the most of it for as long as possible.
Classic Missouri native, not knowing all the ins and outs of all the meshes here. But before we get into the rest of the Denver Outlaw season here and your first season with Denver, just a little bit of background about yourself, Graham, just growing up from in St. Louis, and how'd you get into lacrosse, and how cool is it to be repping the St. Louis area now at the next level?
Yeah, of course. I think I was very fortunate just for starters, just with my family. My dad played at Carolina, so that was kind of our introduction. And I say our, like me and my brothers. I have three brothers, so my dad played at Carolina, and the four of us would always play around. But I looked up, I have two older brothers, one younger who's still at Georgetown, but I always looked up to those guys and even looked up to my younger brother. He's a tremendous athlete, and wanting to do what they were extremely successful at, which for the most part was lacrosse. They played some football and just some good athletes. So I had a lot of good mentorship there with my dad and my brothers. My mom's a tremendous athlete, beats us in most stuff, whether it's pickleball, tennis, you name it. She's competing with the best of them. But and then just kind of the club programs. Andy Kay was huge for MICDS lacrosse. And then the Project Missouri and Project Midwest that's growing in that area. But yeah, I was fortunate. I had two buddies. One went to Penn State, one went to BU, Thomas Dieteringhouse and Hendrick Carpenter. So I've always had a close group of guys that I was extremely competitive with. And when you surround yourself with guys like that, it's easy to continue like up in your game. But yeah, I'm honored to represent Missouri, and I love being there. It's a place that I'll always call home. So it's pretty special that I'm kind of one of the first to make it to the Division I level and the professional level.
Now you're at the professional level with some guys who are just unreal and super talented at every position. Going back to that Redwoods game, I've written about it. Just seeing you and Sam Hanley on the same midfield line is pretty mind-boggling for a guy who covers college most of the time. And seeing you guys as a couple All-Americans, two of the best midfielders the college game has seen in the last handful of years. But to be playing with Brennan O'Neill, now Eric Law comes into the mix. He had the funny soundbite this weekend coming away. Eric Law introduces himself. 10 minutes later, it's the Eric Law School of Film.
Yeah.
So the absolute you guys are really talented offensively. Just what's it like playing with some of these guys like Sam, Eric, and Brennan, among others?
Yeah. Yeah, among others. I mean, we have a great group of guys, and it's been a lot of fun just because we have a lot of rookies playing or younger guys playing, and kind of Sam and Cross are still younger guys. But then you have Justin, Eric, Wisnowskis, unfortunately, has been a little banged up for us, but he was big for us early on, and Law coming in. I mean, I think we're starting to figure it out. You got a lot of guys who need help who are super talented in our rookie class, and then you have guys who've been around the block a while. So we're just I think starting to gel and start to understand each other's games. But it's like you said, it's been surreal. I mean, I was always pushing to compete with the numbers that Sam Hanley was putting up, and I was always looking up to the other guys. I mean, Brennan O'Neill, I've played with him a few times. He's the best player on every field every single time. So whether he produces or not, the defense respects him. It's like you either have two guys on him all game and he's helping us in that way, or you put one guy on him and he's helping us by delivering a bunch of points and assists. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun. We have a great group, and I'm looking forward to see what the rest of the season has for us.
On the other end of the field, another relatively young guy, but a guy that you're very, very familiar with, and that with Owen McElroy, a fellow Hoya, to go with you. Let's listen to some praise he gave you post-game coming away from the win against the Water Dogs.
Graham, your two-pointers were 102 and 101 miles per hour, and your one-pointer was 97. Do you feel the heat coming off your stick when you shoot those at best?
I do. I've been on the other side of this for quite some time now, obviously, so he won't give himself the credit, but I think he's the hardest shooter in the game right now. So I'll let Graham answer his question. Sorry to jump in there, but I had a good miss this flappers.
No comment.
Great little no comment from you there, Graham, just after he knows the amount of power that you're getting on those shots. Just, but what I want to ask you about is this, just the team dynamic at some of these team meals and the locker room, especially. Coach Tim Sudan has hinted at it. The offensive end, like you alluded to, is very, very young, filled with rookies and second-year guys. Defense, Michael Manley, Jesse Bernhardt. These are some vets, all right?
Oh, yeah.
What are the chirps like? What's the banter like now that we're in midseason form, five games in?
Yeah, it's funny. And the funniest part is that it hasn't changed. It wasn't like, oh, we'll take it easy on, like, the rooks. It was like the chirps were flying and you had to get used to it pretty quick. But, yeah, the older guys are awesome just because they – if you chirp them, it's in one ear, out the other. But then they're just delivering stuff right back. So Mike's up there with the best of them. He's had a few years to figure out kind of how to chirp and how to get under people's skin. He's the dad of the team. I mean, we have several dads of the team, but being the oldest guy in the league, he carries that kind of aspect with him. So yeah, it's been pretty cool. We have probably five guys over 30, and then a lot of guys from 22 to 24, 25. Definitely a mix, and it gels pretty well.
And you got older on the offensive end midweek last week, heading into week 7 action with Eric Law rejoining his Denver Outlaws, the team he was on during the MLL days. Just what was it like learning from him in person and in the Zooms and the lead up to that game?
Yeah. I mean, he's a fantastic guy. That's the first thing that stuck out to me. He was just outgoing. He had the confidence that Eric Law should have in terms of what he's done in the professional league, whichever league it may be. But he's he knows so much about the game and has a tremendous amount of respect for every player. You can tell that he's done his research on the guys on the team. Like, he got picked up midweek and he knows the guys on the team where guys want to be. Granted, it's not that hard to know that I want to be in that top left righty shooter spot, because that's where I tend to be all the time. But you have a guy that picks up on tendencies super quickly, loves the game, and has a great appreciation for the guys playing the game. So it's been a blast, and I'm looking forward to kind of him leading our group and just learning more about how to be a successful player at this stage.
Now, Ryan Boyle was giving you some flack in the broadcast booth when your foot was deemed on the line for one of your goals this weekend. What's that like for you, adjusting from coming from high school, college level, where there is no two-point arc, rather, and going into the PLL offenses? How hard is it to stay disciplined and make sure you're behind that line? And what's it like kind of playing off ball from all these playmakers playing with?
Yeah, I was fortunate at Georgetown to play with a bunch of playmakers and guys who distributed the ball pretty well. I've always been comfortable shooting from pretty deep, so it's not something I consciously think about. I just feel like most times the shots that I do like happen to be beyond that arc. The third one, I was just barely inside of it. I looked down before the pass came and like took a few shuffles backwards to like then re-step into it. So it is interesting, just because it's like that one's a bummer. You're just a two goal swing is massive in the game, and it's at times you go on scoring droughts, and canning those is huge to kind of swing momentum or stop their momentum, whatever it may be. So if you're going to shoot from that deep, you may as well make sure that it's an inch, 2 inches behind the line instead of being right on it. So I was pretty bummed when that one was deemed a one-pointer, just because in my head I thought I was behind. But I think I was on the line. I'll make sure that it doesn't happen again, though.
Just growing up watching guys like Kyle Dixon just sling it from deep, like, it's got to be so cool kind of adjusting to that two-point line at the pro rank. Do you wish there was a two-point arc in the college game? Or what's your kind of mindset of kind of having to develop your two-point skills?
I mean, that's just where I found – that's where I was comfortable, and that's where I found the most space. I think that the college game is very much team defense-based, and they slough in. And especially when you have great guys dodging and distributing around you, they tend to slough in. So I was comfortable shooting from that far. So it wasn't ever something I don't think that I had to adjust to. It was something that I feel fortunate that the two-point arc is a part of the PLL game, because I was shooting essentially two-pointers in the college league, making it only worth 1 point. So I feel lucky that it kind of fits my game pretty well, and those are the shots that I feel comfortable taking.
It's cool to hear, like, the Cannons game plan up against the Atlas this weekend, that they make a series of two-pointers, three of them in a row, and that really swings the game wide open. Like you said, it's such a momentum play, and hearing Coach Brian Holman talk about it, like just the way they used to talk about three-pointers and starting to game plan against, like, game plan for those and trying to get those worked into the offense. How cool is that for, like you said, in your game, one of your biggest strengths is as a stretch shooter. You think that's like a part of the game that's going to continue to evolve and search and hunt for twos and coming around screens and stuff in these PLL offenses?
Yeah, I hope so. I think it's pretty cool, and I think there are plenty of talented guys. There's been a bunch of guys this season who've been able to net those two pointers. But yeah, there's a certain aspect of risk to it. You are standing out pretty far away, and if you're not kind of ready to shoot the ball, ready to do something with it, then you're just out there not really being an asset to the offense. So you got to put yourself in the right spots. But yeah, I think it's, like you mentioned, just with the Cannons, you're playing against a team like the Atlas, who's extremely talented offensively, and you put up a few of those two-pointers, and now instead of them kind of falling on their discipline and playing the incredible offense that they can, developing those one-pointers, now it's just like, we worked so hard for that one-pointer, and they just hit two-pointers, and we have to do four more of what we just, like, we grinded to get that one-point goal, and they just come down the field, and someone kind of steps in from 15. It's kind of a heartbreaker, and then you start playing offense a little differently, and it starts to negatively impact in many ways when other teams are able to bury a few two-pointers on you. So I hope to provide a little bit of that for us throughout the year, and we'll see what happens.
How would you describe your shooting form, your release, or whatever you want to call it? Just because the way I see it is, you kind of swoop underneath with if a three quarters is in between overhand and sidearm, then you're kind of like in between underhand and sidearm,
yeah.
Right? Like, it's kind of a swooping up motion. How would you describe your shooting motion?
I don't know exactly, but a lot of people have told me, like, a lot of my buddies, I golf a lot, so a lot of my buddies are just like, there's your golf swing. Like, every week it looks more and more like a golf swing. But yeah, I think that's the swing that's just like kind of comfortable for me, kind of going down there throughout the college and just playing a lot. Like, your body takes a toll, and my shoulders have been a little banged up. So over the top, I started kind of dwindling out of my game. I felt like that was the part of my game, being from the Midwest. You're kind of honing in on those fundamentals, being that fundamentally sound player. And then as you get banged up a little bit, stuff happens, you got to start slowly adjusting, and kind of that's the release that I found that was comfortable and effective.
Now, going into the next level here, just what are some of the other adjustments that you've had to make going from the college game to the pro ranks, in terms of, yeah, less practice time, less prep time, less kind of face-to-face with your teammates, practice before games, and then you get out on the field. What's that been like for you transitioning from the college game into now your rookie season?
Yeah, it's definitely been interesting, like you mentioned, because you don't have that prep time. So not as many plays, not as much scripted. You kind of just rely on everyone being comfortable with each other, and that's going to take time. I think you can see throughout the course of our games, and the Chaos game, we did not play very well in at all, just didn't kind of know each other's games. And then you had the Archers game, where I think Brennan O'Neill just took over the game. It's not like, at times we were playing good fundamental sound and looked good on offense, but for the most part, it was just like, all right, pick Brennan O'Neill's guy, and he's sweeping over the top and bearing seven goals or whatever he had. So that helped out. But I think throughout the course of these games, we've started to develop some chemistry, and that's watching watching film, you can't sit there and watch every game that these guys have. There's only so much that, like, you got to do some, you got to go out there and be an athlete and make some plays. So that's been the cool aspect of it. It's just a bunch of really talented lacrosse players going out on a field and showcasing that talent. But yeah, it's definitely been tricky in the sense that you don't have the same amount of time that you had in college or high school.
Speaking of that Brennan O'Neill game, just what was that like, the witness firsthand? I mean, you mentioned just like he gets some flack sometimes for like the Redwoods completely game plan against him and slid early, double teamed them, open things up for yourself, like we mentioned. But the game before that, like you say, he just totally goes off in that fourth quarter. You guys are down seven. He puts up a 7-point display. Just how cool was that, just from a teammate's perspective?
I mean, yeah, that was that's why he was the number one pick. That's why he's all this hype over his name, and well deserved. But I mean, I've seen it through either watching games or on the USA U21 team. It's something that you kind of expect, and once the game starts, you kind of know how defenses are going to play certain guys. And I think that's the last time that anyone in the league will play Brennan that way, and just kind of leaving him on an island. And he was able to expose his matchup, and we were able to, when he wasn't able to, we were able to set picks and get switches, and then he was taking advantage of that. So I definitely think that everyone has seen how valuable he is, and how you need to game plan for him. So it's, his last few games have been a little different, but he still has so much attention on him, and he's still putting up a hat trick and, or however many goals. He had 3, maybe 4 last game, and he's distributing the ball great too. So whether you game plan for him or not, he's going to be a presence somehow.
What's it like playing for a straight shooter like Tim Sudan?
It's good. It's fun. He's great. He kind of keeps our culture like light. Our guys love being around him, love being around each other. So it's like the locker room is, like you mentioned, you're not around each other a bunch. So having a good locker room is probably one of the biggest assets to the professional league. And he really fosters, and he's the kind of leader of our locker room. But it's been it's been great. He's been great for me, just because he was a shooter back in his day, and a lot of what I do is, I think, what he did really well. So it's been good having a mentor like that. That's kind of an easy resource for me.
Yeah, it's really cool to hear being passed down to the next generation. Yeah. Which is you yourself, Graham. Finishing up the regular season here, just the Boston Cannons here. We talked about their 2-point prowess, and now they're 5-2, also at the top of the league, down in San Diego before heading to Baltimore, and you get to play the Redwoods again for the second time this season, and then you wrap up the regular season, your penultimate weekend is your homecoming, which would be really cool. Might be a weird feeling for yourself as a Hoya playing at Peter Barton, but it'll be your homecoming now at the pro level, and playing the Whips and the Chaos before wrapping up against the Archers. What's the message for the rest of the season here as you look to wrap things up, heading into hopefully a postseason berth?
Yeah. Again, I mentioned this before. All the teams in the league are so good. There's so much talent coming out of the college level, and making 8 teams out of that, you have condensed an extremely talented group of lacrosse players. So on any given day, I think any of the teams could beat any of the other teams. So it's just, consistency is probably the biggest thing there. And just being more consistent than the other team throughout the week, throughout your practice leading up to the game, and then throughout the game is going to be big. And then, I think that our message to each other and the message our older guys have kind of passed down through to us is just making sure that we're getting better, whether it's throughout the week, taking advantage of everyone's on their own. Some guys are, I'm fortunate right now, I haven't started work yet, so I have this time to make sure I'm at the top of my game come game time. Some guys are working jobs, or some guys have families to take care of. So when you have the advantage that I have with time on your hands, or that us rookies have, when you have this amount of time, it's making sure you're taking advantage of every moment, taking advantage of kind of the practices when they come, the film sessions while we're there. And the team meals too, I mentioned the culture was a massive thing. So all those little things add up together and can win you games or can lose you games on the Friday or Saturday.
Well, Graham, consistency will be the key. You were consistently great on your podcast appearance here today. Appreciate you joining the show. And again, good luck the rest of the season. Looking forward to watching you play.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
What a great podcast appearance, Graham. That was awesome. Just thank you again for joining the PL Heavy Hour podcast. Really, let's wrap up here quickly just with some closing remarks as we head out to San Diego with some things that we're looking forward to with the California Redwoods homecoming weekend, starting with the Outlaws playing the Cannons on ESPN at 3 p.m. to start Saturday festivities. Rosie, what's one thing you're looking for in the Outlaws versus Cannons matchup?
I'm going to say one thing I'm looking forward to is Asher Nolting going against JT Giles Harris. Not only is that, you know, a tough matchup on paper, but it is one that Asher Nolting really had some success in last year when they played against each other. You know, JT Giles Harris was coming off of his Defensive Player of the Year award, and I will say Asher Nolting responded by scoring on him and giving him the too small sign. Which is, you know, which is always funny and disrespectful to me. Seeing it against JT Giles Harris, who has probably never been called too small to do anything in his entire life. And like I said, just coming off of that Defensive Player of the Year award. I mean, if I remember it, I'm assuming he remembers it as well. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he has to say about that.
And you have on the other side, this year's reigning Defensive Player of the Year and Garrett Apple going against the first overall pick. I think those two play styles, they'd love to be physical Dodger versus physical kind of meet at the point of contact defenseman. It's going to be fun to watch. And two really elite matchups on both ends of the field as we kind of just an important game, right? Just 3-2 versus 5-2. At this point of the season, it's very interesting that it's like we'll see how it pans out, but one of the final kind of East first West kind of league crossover games for both sides. 5:30 p.m. ESPN Plus, the doubleheader on Saturday night in Torero Stadium, the host of the 2023 World Championship. Great place, for great venue for a lacrosse game. You got to check it out if you're a SoCal fan in the area, because Chaos Redwoods, they're going to be hungry for wins. Rosie, what are we looking for in this one?
Chaos Redwoods, I am curious exactly what the expiration date on revenge games is, and if this is another revenge game for Jules Henningberg, or if you only get one, like is the first time you face them revenge, or can you just be so mad at them that it just keeps being revenge? If that's the case, then, you know, maybe we get a good game out of Jules. He played pretty well last weekend. We saw him playing against the Whip Snakes. I think showing a lot more kind of offensive initiative, kind of realizing, you know, maybe some of this scoring stuff is more on his shoulders than some of the other guys. So he really kind of seemed to do a lot of dodging and setting up. And also he had a very productive game when he did meet his former team, the Redwoods, earlier in the season. So maybe he's got like some little momentum from last week. plus the whole revenge factor. Maybe it's extra double revenge because it's their home game. So maybe he hates them so much that he wants to ruin their homecoming as well. I don't know. When somebody asked him about it, he was like, oh, I don't think about that, because that's what players tend to say to us. And I think mostly they're lying. I don't know about Jules. I'm not calling Jules a liar. I'm just saying generally players act like that stuff isn't a big deal, but people who aren't players are maybe just way more petty. I don't know. But I'm leaning towards maybe they're lying about it a little bit. So maybe we'll get a double revenge game from Jules Hennenberg. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, coming off a pretty good game too against the Whipsnakes in that overtime win. That really nice shifty right to left split and just nails the far side. I'm looking forward to that too, Rosie. Good choice as we head to the third game. 3 of 4 as we go rapid fire kind of in San Diego. Philadelphia Water Dogs, the 1-5 Water Dogs against the 5-2 New York Atlas. Rosie, this one's going to be fun when these two match up. It's, this season at least. This season version of these two teams is going to be a fun matchup. Rosie, what should we be looking out for in the first leg of Saturday's doubleheader?
So the last time New York lost this season, it was against the Whipsnakes, and they came out the following time they were on the field and opened one up on the unsuspecting Denver Outlaws, and it was a brutal whooping from start to finish. So I am curious if that said more about where the Outlaws were at that time, or if this is just the way that New York bounces back from losing. You know, having had so much experience winning early in the season and looking so sharp, you know, you get popped in the mouth. How do you respond? We've seen them do it once. So I'm very curious to see if they come out that, you know, aggressive, that hungry. You know, maybe we see a similar sort of defensive lockdown on, you know, one of the Water Dogs star players. Easier said than done, but, you know, we'll see what Gavin Adler has in store for this matchup. And, you know, we'll see how Teat and Schellenberger and the rest of the gang bounce back after last week. I have to imagine, as hard as they seem to be on themselves, they respond accordingly. But again, easier said than done that as well. So, you know, trying to fire on Dylan Ward, trying to get by guys like Ben Randall is never all that easy. So we'll see what they can do, but I'm looking forward to seeing if they bounce back the same way they bounced back after
the worst thing that could have happened other than losing themselves was, of course, the Boston Cannons finding a way past the Atlas last weekend, because like you said, coming off a loss, all eyes on how the Atlas respond against a super hungry Dogs team. Like, now is not the time to keep losing. 5 losses already, and you got the Atlas, you got the Whipsnakes, and you got the Redwoods, and to end the season again, you got the Atlas. So this is the first of 2 Atlas meetings to really pick things and turn things around if you're a Water Dogs fan. So last game of the weekend, the Whipsnakes versus the Redwoods, 5:30 p.m. on ESPN+. Rosie, what are you looking forward to in a game like this?
Well, I mean, I guess a lot is in the air to be decided by what happens in that first game. Maybe Rob Pinnell's 600th point comes in this one, or maybe he gets it out of the way in the first one. I think he's at 596, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 597. So, you know, maybe it's not even going to be a matter of discussion at that point. But I think that'll be a big deal. Hopefully the league does something to kind of you know, at least get them the ball or something like that, but hopefully they got a little something more prepared than that, because I don't know when we'll see it again from pure PLL players, just because, you know, the scoring is much lowered than, you know, some of the guys who had their time in the MLL. So I mean, as far as actual on-field stuff, I mean, it's really, I think a lot of it's just going to come down to, is this going to be a game that the Redwoods can win? Is it going to be like we saw with the Chaos game, you know, kind of a sort of a slugfest, you know, first person to double digits wins, right? Because, I mean, that might be the kind of redwood ball that they really need to be victorious here. And, you know, if they do, maybe it's a 2-win swing this weekend for them, or maybe they can split the series. They got to get something or they will be in great danger.
Yeah, like you said, like making fans trust the process this early in the season, maybe not the best idea when you kind of have the two most ideal opponents for your homecoming weekend and Chaos, who really can't put up a lot of goals themselves, and then the Whip Snakes are also struggling on that end of the field too. Defense, you've been nice and organized and structured with, so it's really just a matter of that midfield production. Can they hit it this weekend? San Diego fans, will you show up? It'll be fun to see. A lot of fans are Redwoods fans, no matter where the league goes on this. We're still in the tour-based model, Chris, so let's get a good homecoming weekend for the Redwoods. Thanks for so much for listening to the latest PLL Happy Hour podcast. Chris, give us a nice closing remark as we sign off.
Yeah, thanks again. Just like echoing what Kevin said, thank you for listening. Feel free to send your feedback and commentary our way on any one of our social media things or wherever you are listening to this podcast, especially if it is nice. We don't want to hear your negative garbage otherwise. That being said, looking forward to doing the next one, and we will catch you on Inside Lacrosse. We got a whole bunch of articles coming out, as we always do each and every week. Play fantasy lacrosse, join up our league and go against us, and we will catch you next time.
Peace.